casual glance at the Polk County Courthouse in Des Moines will tell you that it's a beautiful building. You have to look closer to see the faces. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. On the facade of the Polk County Courthouse, there are 28 unique faces carved in stone. These faces are called grotesques and adorn buildings all over Iowa and all over the world. My guest today is Jan Fleming, who has made it her mission to search out and document these stone faces. She's shared what she has found in two volumes of Grotesques in Des Moines, Iowa, and abroad. We'll talk about grotesques, gargoyles, and green men, both medieval and modern. Then later in the hour, we'll take another trip through time with the Living Nickelodeon. University of Iowa professor Rick Altman will take us back in time to the early days of cinema. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Polk County Courthouse in Des Moines was built in 1906. It is a beautiful building by any standards, but you have to look a lot closer at the building to see the faces. It's those faces on the building, 28 of them, that inspired my guest Jan Fleming to set off on a quest that has resulted in two volumes of Grotesques in Des Moines, Iowa, and abroad. And as we talk about these faces carved in stone, we'd love to hear about the faces that you've seen, maybe some of your favorite over the years. 866-780-9100 at IPR Talk, or send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Hello, Jan.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I want to start at the Polk County Courthouse. That's where you start in your books. And there are 28 unique faces on the facade of that building. If you're looking at the building, where are they?
It's a very, very wonderful thing that this may be the only building in the world that you can walk around and actually just look up at them. They are above the second story windows, but they are visible just walking around. Even driving around, you can see them. And the 28 faces are just part of the faces on the courthouse. There are some beautiful carvings of women. So we did a section on the women of the Polk County Courthouse, also in the book.
Well, let's talk about these faces. The technical term is grotesques. These are grotesques. Why are they called that?
In about 400 A.D., they started a contest in London, and it was called face-pulling or gurning, and it still goes on April 1st. Who can make the most ridiculous face? At that same time, these funny faces and face-pullings began to appear on buildings. We don't know which came first. And the term grotesque has taken on a whole new meaning since I've done the book, because there are some other categories. I'm kind of proud that I'm the first one to define some of the subcategories, because not all of the faces, for example, on the Polk County Courthouse are grotesques. Some of them are very, very beautiful. And a new category that it just must get out there is that a lot of them are commemorative faces. The image of the Indian is said to be an Indian chief that was in the Meskwaki tribe at the time the building was built. And there's a beautiful visage of a woman, and another one that looks like a princess. And the story goes around, and we don't know if it's true or not, that when the stone carvers fell in love with an Indian maiden. And the very, very sad thing about all of this is that we don't know who carved them, what they had in mind. And this is not only true here, it's true all across Europe. What we do know about these stone carvers, and it makes me very sad to think about this, is that they passed their craft down through families, and that they were, I guess, illiterate. And they never thought to leave their names, and it makes me even sadder to think that the people around them didn't somehow document who did these remarkable carvings. And one of the important things to say is that the stone carvings in Des Moines and around Iowa will rival anything you will see in Europe. We have some stunning, stunning artwork. For example, on top of the Lincoln High School, we have the Unseeing Reader and the Nose Picker. And these are themes that went through colleges and universities in Europe and even across this country. And if you compare the Nose Picker at Oxford with the Nose Picker on Lincoln High School, the one on Lincoln is so much, there is so much more artistry to it and detail. It's actually better than the one on Oxford in England. So we have so much to be proud of here. And I'm so hoping that going to see these and talking about them and photographing them will just become part of the Iowa experience, because we have some absolutely amazing carvings.
Well, when I think about these faces, and let's go back to the courthouse again. It was built in 1906, and these stone carvings are really intricate and obviously took a lot of time and effort to create. Some of them are quite grotesque. Some of them are very funny, very odd. And when I think about that time in Iowa, it seems kind of incongruous that someone was building a building and saying, why don't you put a funny face up there and let's devote a lot of time and effort into making it really intricate. Do we have any idea why this was done?
I have had the same thought. We are rather known as a conservative state. And back
practical.
In 1906, thank you, I like that better. And I have had the same thought. Who gave permission to do this? I did find, and they're on the inside covers of the books, the original drawings by the architects. And Mr. Bird had drawn a green man above one of the windows. So he had it in mind from the very beginning. These categories are very important, because what we've talked about as grotesques is just not accurate. There are beautiful commemorative faces. We have two of them on the spire at the old main building on Grandview College. And Fairfield, the old public library, has just beautiful visages on eye level, right, as you go up the steps. And it was originally a Carnegie library, and it was the first Carnegie library built west of Pennsylvania, which is really quite interesting. And even though it isn't documented and we don't know who carved them, I'm thinking that they must have been in honor of the Carnegies. There's another set of commemorative faces. I've lost it at the moment. But in Chicago, there are quite a number, and also up in Dubuque.
Well, let's go through the categories a little bit, because we've talked about grotesques, and these are kind of these distorted faces, as if someone were making a funny face. And some of them are very, very frightening, and some of them look humorous. So they come in sort of categories there as well, but they are a distorted face.
Right. And you mentioned the word frightening. And when people bring this up and they say, oh my, the devil, and I say, no. They're just scary faces. Look what we've done with Halloween. We love to dress up and scare people and be scared. So I think it's just that simple. There certainly is nowhere across the world have I been able to find a carving that is representing the devil. So I hope that we can get that out of the way. Also, that it's they're pagan gods. And in the book, I write that I think the pagans got a bad rap. What choice did they have at 400 BC when the green man started appearing on buildings?
Well, let's talk about the green man, because especially in your second volume, you focus a lot on this kind of face, the green man. Can you describe that for us?
Yes, a face that is surrounded by leaves. The leaves, actually, the foliage can be coming out of the eyes, the nose, the mouth. And what the green man represents is our oneness with nature. He is not a spooky god at all. And most of them
are tremendous.
How
do you know that that's what it represents?
A lot of research was done by someone before me, thank goodness, because it was very, very heavy. a book came out in, I think it was 1998, called Green Man, and it was researched very, very heavily by William Anderson and photographed by Clive Hicks, who is also a contributor to our book, which is quite wonderful. Many of his gorgeous photography of Green Man in Europe are in the second volume of the book. But that's what they discovered. They couldn't find anything that said that it was connected to any kind of religious ceremony that may have connected with it later on. But in its origin, pagan is the Latin word for farmer. And those people didn't travel. They lived off the land and under the trees. They were their sanctuary. They were their homes, and they paid tribute to nature through the Green Man. So he's really quite a wonderful figure, and not a pagan god.
How do you distinguish the Green Man from other grotesques? Because in many cases, the faces are quite similar.
Right. There's what do we call them, crossovers? There's some crossovers with funny faces and leaves. And in my mind, I just say, okay, there's a humorous Green Man. These stone carvers had such imaginations that the diversity of what they did, there are very few duplications. However, two of the Green Men on the Polk County Courthouse are very, very like ones that are scattered all over Europe. They almost look the same. I'm sure that the stone carvers were trying to copy them. And so they have become a very strong tradition.
Where do women fall into these categories? Because women are very underrepresented in stone carvings, it seems to me.
They certainly are. We found Clive Hicks in London helped me find about four or five across Europe. And there are women on the Polk County Courthouse representing blind justice, for example. There are very few green women. The one on the Fairfield Library, the man and the woman, even though the faces are very, very human, but they are also surrounded by foliage.
Well, we will talk more about green men and the very few green women that are represented in just a few minutes. My guest is Jan Fleming. She is the author and photographer of many of the faces in two volumes called Grotesques in Des Moines, Iowa, and Abroad. And we'd love to hear about the faces that you've found. Maybe there were stone faces on your high school or on your town bank that you've been admiring over the years. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity, and my guest right now is Jan Fleming. And we're talking about the stone carvings that you see on buildings around the state of Iowa and around the world. They're called grotesques in some cases. We'll talk about the green men that you see and what technically constitutes a gargoyle. And we'd love to hear from you as well if there are stone carvings that you've been admiring on the buildings in your community or that you've discovered somewhere. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And later on the program, we're also going to take another trip through time, through the early days of cinema and the living Nickelodeon. That's coming up in about 15 minutes. Jan, when did you first become fascinated with these faces?
It was just an accident. Somebody said to me one day, "Have you seen the faces around the Polk County Courthouse?" And I said, "What faces?" So I walked down there, and it just took my breath away. I couldn't believe the beauty and the artistic integrity of what we have here. And you just brought up something that I think is very important. What is the difference between a gargoyle and a grotesque? A gargoyle, by definition, has to carry water. There is a legend of Gargouille, a dragon who was going into the village of Rouen in France and stealing virgins and ravishing them and killing them. So a priest showed up and said, "I will get rid of your dragon if you will build a church and I'll join the church." So he did the, now this is a legend, mind you, he did the bell, book, and candle ritual and slayed the dragon and hauled him away with the ropes around his robe. But the head lived, and they put the head on a pole or something, and that's where the legend of Gargouille or gargoyles started. It the word gargouille is from ancient French, and it means carrying water. It's where our words gargle and gurgle come from.
So we think of them as little statues, but actually they were the original downspouts.
That's right. And I found only one in Des Moines that is really an authentic gargoyle, and it's on the home of Kirk Blunk, the architect, in Waterbury Circle, or Waterbury Road, one of the other. And it is no longer used for that, but it was originally, there were two of them put on the house that actually carried water.
When you took your friend's advice and you went and you looked at these faces on the Polk County Courthouse, what was it that really grabbed you? Why? What set you off on this quest?
First of all, they're stunning artwork. We have an historic art treasure in Des Moines and around Iowa, and my hope is that people will be arriving with their cameras and touring all over looking for these. What set me off? I just thought they were absolutely amazing, and I saw the artwork that just was so amazing, and I thought, I've lived in and around Des Moines for about 35 years, didn't know they were there, and I thought everybody should know that they are there and see them. And of course, then the whole thing spread all over the state, which leads me to the upside downness. May I talk about that for a minute?
Sure.
When I went up to Dubuque, there was this really, really intricately carved green man. I call them fantastic green men, with so much foliage and decoration around them. My little neighbor girl calls them fancy green men. At age 4. And one day, the photograph was lying upside down on...
Where in Dubuque did you find this one?
Uh-huh. It's an empty building right now, or at least the last time I was up there. It's about 3 blocks north of the Julian Hotel. And it is really the centerpiece now of book 2, because it is so remarkable. Because when I looked at it upside down, it was an owl. So then, having lunch one day at Walman's Pub, I picked up the New York Times art and leisure section, an artist, Archimboldo, 17th century, and he painted everything out of vegetables and fruits. He'd go to the market and get vegetables and fruits and display them into faces and then paint them. And they're absolutely wonderful. They're just great. And in following up on him, he had one called The Gardener, and when you turned him upside down, he was a bowl of fruit. And then I found out with research that artists back at that time were doing this upside down thing, but nobody I contacted, the Library of Congress, all the stone carvers I know, current day, across the country, across Europe, and one of them has libraries of very, very old Italian stone carvings. Nobody could find anything ever printed about this upside down phenomenon. And then we discovered a bunch more, and they are at the end of book 2. And this is a first time printing for this really remarkable thing. One of the upside down ones at the end of the book is a green man, and then you turn him upside down, and I swear he is a dog on a motorcycle with goggles. They're just amazing, and we are the first to publish them. So there is that. One other thing I wanted to talk about is the Washington National Cathedral.
Well, yes, let's, before we get to that.
Okay.
So we were talking about the early part of the 20th century when this Polk County Courthouse was built and when many of these buildings went up and stone carvers mm-hmm. were still traveling around and doing these faces. And of course, this had been done in Europe for a very long time. When did it stop happening? When did buildings stop featuring these faces?
That's a very interesting question, and I cannot find anything that has been done except at the Washington National Cathedral on buildings since around 1907. There may be some, but I couldn't find any documented. And that's the other sad thing. If these families were passing this craft down over the centuries, where did they go? And what are the offsprings doing? Where are they? We don't know. It is just very sad. Yes.
It's interesting, too, that you show a lot of, and we'll talk about the National Cathedral in just a moment, but you show a lot of pictures of these faces on churches around the world. And mm-hmm. as strange as it may seem to see these stone faces on a courthouse or these stone faces on a high school, it's even weirder to see some of these really, and grotesque is a great word for them, these grotesque faces on churches. Do we understand that tradition?
We can only suppose. There's a wonderful video that I've lost track of and I'm trying to find. Guardians of the Gate, and some architectural historians from Yale or Princeton or both made this documentary on that very subject, and they ended up with the thought that these very weird and scary creatures on churches are one of two things, or maybe both, that they are warning the public of the evil world outside, or they're keeping evil outside of the church. We don't know. We can only surmise.
Only
speculate. Isn't that sad?
But it is.
Yes.
And it's very odd to look at these pictures. Because they, especially when you talk about the green men, they do evoke sort of an ancient mysticism. You see the men, mostly men, surrounded by leaves, with leaves or branches growing out of their mouths and growing out of their ears. It's very odd imagery, and it does make you think of a different kind of religion.
Okay. I guess I would debate that. I don't really know why that is necessary to think of it as a religion. It was certainly a tribute that people were making to the power of nature in their lives, whether they worshipped or made a religion of it. I think that came into the years of AD, and there were some groups that made it a deity, I guess, of a sort. But I just don't believe that's what it was meant to be. A lot of research has been done into that, and that's what the experts have come up with. That the green men are an expression of our oneness with the universe and nature.
Let's talk about the National Cathedral, because that is,
yes,
as you said, the one place where some of the stone carving has continued, even to this day. Tell me about some of the artwork at the cathedral.
It's amazing, and I'm fortunate enough to, I accidentally started photographing it when I was doing book one, which is another long story. But when I started using the photographs in the book, I started getting in touch with the stone carvers at the Washington National Cathedral, and they have been very supportive, and they have submitted their work. And the 100th anniversary of the building of the cathedral, the 100th birthday, the stone carvers invited me in because they were very grateful that I was producing their work in a book to get their work out there. And I even got to go to the very, very tippy top where no one gets to go and stand cheek to cheek with some of the gargoyles. They have an unusual, and current day they have stopped because the cathedral, like everything else, is in financial trouble, sadly. But these stone carvers have gone on their own. They have studios and they are doing works. You can go on websites and order their work. They're doing fireplaces and fountains, and Walter Arnold in Chicago is very prolific with that sort of thing all over the country. But back to the cathedral, they are very unusual in that they really are gargoyles, most of them, because they really do carry water off the roof or off the side of the building. But they have done things like a bulldog. They've done Darth Vader. So they've mixed the modern images with the old function of the gargoyle. And visiting the cathedral, for anybody who's interested, is an absolute must. It's just every inch there is a figure carved. I swear.
It's fascinating to me that again, that much effort has been put into it. And many of these are very difficult to see.
That's true. It is a shame that they put them up so high. We have given two tours of the grotesques here in Des Moines and the gargoyle. Well, not the gargoyle. It was out of reach. But when we've gone to Lincoln High School, both times we had retired teachers from Lincoln High, at least one or two on the tour, and they all three said, I taught there for maybe 20 years or whatever it was. I never knew they were there. They're way up at the top. And it's a real shame, isn't it, that they are so high. And I have hung out of third-story windows to photograph the figures across the street. I've been up in a cherry picker to get the ones that were up very, very high. Excuse me. And it is very sad that there's so much beauty up there. When I do a book signing or sign people's books, I say, be sure to look up. That's where most of them are.
Well, let's talk about some of the other stone carvings that you can see around the state of Iowa so that people who are in those areas will look mm-hmm. up. You have several mm-hmm. pictures that you've printed from Dubuque. Where in Dubuque can we find some of these faces?
Yes, Dubuque is a treasure, and I have a feeling that there were many, many more that have gotten torn down. Dubuque High School has some very, very funny figures, and I'm also tempted to think that there may be commemorative figures also because it's a man and a woman on either side of the door, but they are face-pulling, and they're just a scream. Downtown, Old Town Dubuque, there is the Fisher Building and what was the Stamford Building. It is now an insurance company. And the artwork on their third-story facades are they're just incredible. And then, of course, our centerpiece, which is down by the Julian Hotel. I'm going to get up to Dubuque soon and find out what's going on with that building. We can't even contemplate them tearing it down. I have to keep an eye on it.
Well, a lot of these faces you do show in your book have been saved from buildings that have been torn down. So there does seem to be a movement to rescue these faces before they make it to the landfill.
That's true of the Hub Tower in Des Moines. They saved a face from a building that was being torn down, catty corner from that building. And then they made replicas that they put all around the Hub Tower. Now, they're up fairly high. You have to really be looking up to see those. And that was done by, let's see if I can say this right, Kirk Blunk's architectural firm. Kirk Blunk is very into this, and he and his colleagues saved them for the Hub Tower.
You also,
so we've got to do more.
In your book, you cite examples in Grinnell. You mentioned in Fairfield on the library. And there are a few faces that you also mention in Iowa City. So if people pick up the book, they can find something close to home. But what do you want people to take away from this mostly as they travel around their own communities?
That these are art treasures. That it's a unique – they are still using the same tools that they used 400 years ago, a chisel and a mallet. Whop, whop. That's how they are still – that's how they're carving them at the cathedral. That this is artistry beyond comprehension, because one slip of that chisel and I guess their work would be ruined. And you did mention Grinnell.
Right.
That the door of the Grinnell Bank there, it's a Louis Sullivan Bank. I've been to Europe and I've seen a lot of really, really beautiful doors, but I never saw one more beautiful than the door at the bank in Grinnell. And you mentioned other cities. There's a wonderful carving up. Oh, I'm getting cut off, huh? There's
a
wonderful
carving. We are out of time, Jan.
Oh.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Okay. Thank you so much for being interested.
Jan Fleming has shared many of the faces that she has found in two volumes of Grotesques in Des Moines, Iowa, and Abroad. And if you go to the website gargoylesandgrotesques.com, you can see many of those faces as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and now we're traveling back in time to the early days of cinema. Rick Altman is a professor of cinema and comparative literature at the University of Iowa. Tonight, he'll present The Living Nickelodeon, a film and lecture at the Bijou Theater at the Iowa Memorial Union. Rick, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
What is a Nickelodeon?
Nickelodeons were small theaters, often replacing a store, so they're sometimes called storefronts, that were built starting mainly around 1905, and they were replaced around 1913, 14, 15 by large theaters that were purpose-built.
So this was a fairly brief period of time for these Nickelodeons.
It was a brief period of time, but it was an extraordinary event for this country. What happened was that whereas there had been hundreds of theaters that housed melodramas and other kinds of live entertainment, vaudeville and so forth, there were tens of thousands of Nickelodeons, many of them holding only 100 to 200 people. But you multiply 10,000 by that figure and you realize that it's quite a movement within the country.
Very accessible for people. When people went to the Nickelodeon, what did they see?
That's actually one of the reasons why we dreamed up this performance that we're going to do tonight. For a long time, it was understood that Nickelodeons were film theaters. What happens in a film theater? You show films, obviously. Well, sometimes the obvious isn't really the truth. I was working on a book that turned out to be the book Silent Film Sound that I published several years ago, and I started discovering things that opened my eyes and my ears. I found that in spite of the fact that we always assumed that these Nickelodeons were film theaters, in fact, they always or almost always featured music. And in many cases, the music was the headliner, not the film. And the music came from a form that is virtually unknown, illustrated songs. And here's what an illustrated song is. The publishers of songs, understanding that any way to get their songs sung was good publicity, decided that it would be useful to take a system that had been introduced in vaudeville but only in little bits here and there and expand it nationally. What they did was they hired small companies to make slides that would illustrate each line of their song. So figuring four lines per verse, four lines per chorus, with two verses, two choruses, that would make 16 slides – the opening slide being the cover of the sheet music and the closing slide being the lyrics of the chorus. It took about 18 slides, and these slides were regularly shown in Nickelodeons, accompanied by a pianist, someone to sing the song, who sometimes, alas, was the pianist. And in addition to the pianist and the singer, you would have these extraordinarily beautiful slides regularly projected, and at the end, the audience would be invited to sing along.
So it sounds a little bit like a primitive karaoke.
In a sense, though, it's an interesting combination of the people who are supposed to know how to play the piano and sing, giving the prompt to the audience. So you not only had the professionals, you also had the audience.
At that time, of course, you couldn't go out and buy a recording of popular music. Was this one of the ways that songs made their way across the country through the Nickelodeons?
Actually, it was possible to buy recordings at this time. They would be on cylinders as often as they would be on discs. And one of the reasons that's given for the fall of illustrated songs around 1913 is that the piano began to be replaced in the home by a phonograph. Exactly. But the real key is the sheet music and the pianos. Everybody had a piano. Pianos were cheap. And the sheet music would, in many cases, be sold at the exit of the Nickelodeon. And since, in general, these illustrated songs were bankrolled by the Tin Pan Alley music publishers, they had every interest in getting their sheet music out.
A fabulous marketing technique.
Not only a fabulous marketing technique, but it changed a lot of our ideas about how silent films were accompanied. One of the things that I discovered in my research was a number of sets of instructions for pianists, which said things like, while the song is being played, the pianist is at his station accompanying. But when the song is over during the films, the pianist can go out and have a cigarette. What? The pianist goes out during the film? It was an enormous surprise to me.
Right, because we've always thought about these silent films as being accompanied by piano
absolutely.
Music throughout.
And we discovered that many of them were, but that there was a period when silence was extremely common. We also discovered that many of the people who came to the cinema to accompany films, they knew how to play the piano. How had they learned how to play the piano? Well, they had learned with Beethoven, Mozart, and Schumann. But that's what they started playing. But by the time they had been doing this for 3 years, playing two new illustrated songs every week, dozens of times for each song, what was their repertory? Their repertory was popular American music. And so they began to use that popular music to accompany the films, and sometimes in very disrespectful ways. If, for example, the mother-in-law shows up, well, you play the old gray mare. The old gray mare. Well, that's kidding the film, and that's what they called it. And pianists regularly began kidding the film when their repertoire was all of these popular songs, all of which have words, whereas the Beethoven, the Mozart, and the Schumann, most of it is without words.
Well, that's so fascinating to think of, because that would have changed the experience of watching the film so much that the music in many ways would have been more powerful than the images.
And indeed, because the music was so powerful, that's what was advertised. The professionals were often the singers. In many cases, for example, a quartet of singers would be engaged to do one of the illustrated songs, and a classically trained singer might do a solo for another of the illustrated songs. Well, these were advertised on the sandwich boards out front of the theaters. It was really important because this was a period when live music was absolutely essential to America. You just couldn't do without it. You couldn't open a store. You couldn't hold a parade. You couldn't have a wedding. Everything had to have live music.
What about the films? What kinds of images were people seeing?
amazing variety of things, everything from the electrocution of an elephant to joking matches between a fat guy and a thin guy so skinny that he can get rolled up, literally. Animation was very often combined with live action. Many of the films were quite short. And another of the things that we discovered and that we exploit in the performance this evening is the number of films that said, wait a minute, these illustrated songs are getting all the attention. Maybe we ought to make films that could be sung to. And so I'll be playing a number of songs that were devised in order to match popular music so that when people went to the theater, they wouldn't be just getting illustrated songs from the slides. They would also be getting illustrated songs from the films themselves.
Eve is on the line from Coralville at 866-780-9100. Hello, Eve.
Hi. I was wondering if Silly Symphonies, which followed the 1920s, the Follow the Bouncing Ball, was a direct descendant of this.
In a way, it was a direct descendant. It, you're right, didn't start until the 20s. The Silly Symphonies themselves are actually a mid-30s phenomenon. But the Follow the Bouncing Ball was part of an enormous phenomenon in the 20s that involved organ slides. Now, the slides that I'll be showing tonight don't have any lyrics printed on the bottom of them. You have to wait until the third chorus for the audience to be allowed to sing, and at that point, all of the words of the chorus are projected onto the screen. Whereas the organ slides that took over from song slides and that were especially popular in the 20s, they were one line at a time printed on the bottom of the slide. So in this case, usually the organist would play the organ and people would be expected to sing along. There was no performance of the song other than what the organist and the audience did at that point.
Interesting combination.
All right, Eve, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 866-780-9100. So the music was the headliner at the Nickelodeons. Were there movie stars that were also a draw back then?
Not at that point. The movie star system really didn't begin until around 1910. In fact, it's absolutely fascinating. I published some of these pages in my book to look at a page of advertisements for theaters around 1909, 1910. What do you read? Well, in most cases, you read no specificity on what the film is, not even the title of the film. But the stars were what were called the song illustrators, the people who sang the songs. And they are regularly named by name in the advertisements. They would also be named by name in the advertisements out in front of the theater, so strong at the time was the interest in live music.
Would these have been local performers or were there performers that traveled to different Nickelodeons?
No, there were never performers that traveled around from Nickelodeon to Nickelodeon, but illustrated songs got their start when vaudeville entertainers thought, well, instead of just singing, oh, maybe I could illustrate my song. And hey, since I'm projecting slides, I guess I might as well put the lyrics up and get the audience to sing along. So the first half a dozen years from 1895 to the early 20th century of illustrated songs usually involved just a single set of slides that was made specifically for a vaudeville entertainer. It wasn't until the new century that the idea came along that, gee, this is pretty good publicity for our songs.
So there was the music, there were the movies. Were there any other parts of the performance that people would have seen? Were there live performances that varied from that?
There were lots of theaters that did what was called vaudepick, combination of vaudeville and pictures. And there were also competitions. There might be one night a week when they had an amateur hour and people could get up and sing. It was an extremely lively theater, the Nickelodeon. And indeed, wherever I've given this performance, I've tried to make sure that I had a few Confederates in the audience who would make some trouble, who would complain about the guy next to them who's touching them, who would comment about the pictures, particularly at the time when the pictures would be shown without any kind of accompaniment. It just seems to call for wisecracks. So in some ways, while there were no Rocky Horror Picture Shows at the time, that kind of audience involvement was very much involved in the Living Nickelodeon.
Was admission always a nickel?
It was a nickel to start with, though it grew to a dime before too long. And you have to understand that in downtown theaters, there might be six of them on the same block, and the shows might be as short as 10 or 12 minutes. So there are cases where people ran as many as 40 shows a day, whereas in the country, they might have a show only once a week on Saturday night, and it might last for an hour and a half.
Did you have to leave at the end of the show, or could you stay for another performance?
Actually, the slides, some of which I'll be showing tonight, say quite clearly, if you haven't seen the whole show, stick around. More is coming.
What caused the demise of the Nickelodeon Theater?
It used to be said that they fell onto difficult times because they were a little bit racy. And yes, folks, they were a little bit racy in the teens, but that strikes me as not the whole story. The big story is that during the period from about 1905 to 1909, the producers had a hard time producing enough material, enough film material, to differentiate the theaters. So different theaters were playing the same movies on the same block. As of about 1912, the feature film came along. There was lots of, as they called it, product available. And the film producers wanted their share of the exhibition time back. And so they did a pretty good job of getting rid of the Illustrated Song. And after 1913, they pretty much disappeared.
And then the rise of the more elaborate theaters, that the Art Deco kind of
Absolutely.
Theaters that we can still see some of today.
Right.
Not very many. So when you put on this performance, what do you think people are most shocked to learn about the Nickelodeons?
They're shocked to find out that there were no such thing as film projectors, that it was a little bit more complicated than that, and that the technology is really interesting. They're amazed at the variety of the slides. They are just stupefied by the beauty of some of the slides. They're all hand-painted by teams of women on glass 3x4 slides. They are amazed at the number of different photographs that are matted together in some of the slides, these wonderful slides where babies are coming out of tulips, where three or four things are happening, where in order to speak from one end of a telephone to another, you follow the cord. And there are obviously four or five different photographs that are matted in.
Well, Rick, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Rick Altman is a professor of cinema and comparative literature at the University of Iowa. And tonight he'll present The Living Nickelodeon, a film and lecture at the Bijou Theater at the Iowa Memorial Union. That's at 7 o'clock tonight. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Alex Hoyer. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Technical support today from John Pemble in Des Moines. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow we'll go off the beaten path in Iowa with Lori Erickson. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.